start the afternoon. Kenneth's going to read the preamble for us.
My name's Ken. I'm an alcoholic.
Ken, sorry.
An Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Ken. And do you want a drink, Teresa? Are you all right? You want
yes,
a drink?
Lovely.
Do you want a drink of water or anything?
Pardon?
Do you want a drink of water? Are you all right?
Later on, coffee.
All right, yeah. I forgot the tray. All right, I'll delegate, Teresa, all right? Okay, right, and I'd like to welcome Gloria, who's going to open the afternoon for us.
Thank you. I thought you had the preamble.
We had it, didn't we?
Yeah. Did we? Yeah. Well, wake up. Well, thank you, and I'd like to thank Larry for inviting me. My name's Gloria, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Larry, for inviting me down to here. And I think that came via my sponsee, so it's nice when your sponsees get you into doing a bit of service, isn't it? But I'm not enjoying this. I'm nervous, and that's not a bad thing, I suppose. Anyway, it took me a long time to get to this space where I am today. And my drinking was quite uneventful, wasn't exciting, it was just drab, really. Started off okay. I was quite a young mum, had three lovely children, nice husband and home. And we made friends with neighbours when we moved, and we started playing cards once a week, Wednesday or Saturday or one night anyway. And we used to buy a bottle of draft sherry, and the blokes used to have four cans of lager or something between them, and me and her had the sherry. And by the end of the evening, we was giggling and silly, and thought we'd had a great time. And run forward a few years, and I'm drinking a bottle of vodka a day. I've lost a lot of friends, stopped being asked to parties because I'm an embarrassment. I humiliated my husband, I flirted with other people. And I changed. My personality changed. I didn't think I changed. I thought my husband became miserable and found fault. And I said, it used to be fun to go to a party with, you know, fun anymore, because he wanted to go home at 3 o'clock and I didn't. And apart from anything else, I just got loud, obnoxious and downright unruly. And a couple of times he said, if you don't leave, I'll go without you. Well, I don't care. Go then. Of course, it was just a recipe for rows and deterioration within the marriage. And all this took years. It didn't happen in 6 months. It happened over a period of time that I hardly noticed it happening, really. And by the time it was bad, it wasn't my fault. And if my husband told me what my behaviour was like the night before, I reckon he made it up, because I didn't believe I'd done and said half the things he said I did. And I'd done a few geographicals. I didn't know what this word meant until I didn't know half what I know today until I came into the fellowship. The words we use in the fellowship, we use them daily now, and a newcomer must wonder what we're on about, especially when we mention the big book. A newcomer came up to me afterwards and said, do we have to read the Bible? And I said, no, you don't. Who said you had to read the Bible? She said, you're all going on about this big book. I said, oh, it's not that big book, no. It's what we call our blue book. So it's a bit of a mystery to a newcomer, all this language that we use. And obviously I didn't know what blackouts were or geographicals. And if we had a row, which we invariably did when my husband got home from work, because we had a dog, and he used to say hello to the dog first. And that really, really, that was one of my big resentments when I got sober. That went on my resentment list, because He always knelt down and made a fuss of the dog. What about me? And anyway, if he asked me what I've been up to all day, I thought he was prying. So that was a row. And if he didn't ask, well, I thought he didn't care. Don't ask me what I've been doing all day then. Anyway, I'm not putting up with this. And I get a bottle, or I go out and buy a bottle out and go sit in a churchyard somewhere and drink it. Maybe I'd fall asleep, maybe I wouldn't, but invariably I passed out into blackout and came home whatever time. And I tried to get in one night. I came home and I tried to get in the French doors so that I could get on the settee, so when he came down I could say I'd been there all night. And he was in there, he was sat on the settee. And I got in the French doors and he'd been waiting up for me. And I really resented that, you know, more checking up on me, more trying to catch me out. I was paranoid about not getting caught. And when he came home from work sometimes, the drinking by now was daily. I was drinking at lunchtime right the way through to the evening. It had started about 6 o'clock in the evening to start with a gin and tonic when he came home from work, because we had a holiday abroad for the first time in years, and we had a gin and tonic on the beach before dinner. And then when we come home from holiday, I thought it was civilised to do it. So we carried on having gin and tonics, but they were big ones, and different gin, and not just one. So that was the evening start, early evening, and then it just got earlier and earlier, and it started at lunchtime in the end. And when he come home at work at 5 o'clock, he'd say, "You've been drinking." And I'd stand there with my hands on the settee and say, "No." And if I let go of the settee, I probably would have fallen over. But I stood there and said, "No." And he said, "I can tell you that." I thought, how does he know? How can he tell? And I went into the bathroom, looked in the mirror to see, what's he looking at? How can he tell I've had a drink? It's obvious, I can tell a drunk now from 100 paces, you know. So, I mean, it was obvious. But I expected to be believed, you know, when I was such a liar, but I was indignant if you didn't believe it. It was really weird. My thinking was completely wrong. And my personality had gone from being friendly, helpful, wanting to have friends around me, wanting to go out and socialise, be quite nice, cooking. I had three kids, I used to make their clothes. All that stopped. I felt used, taken for granted. Life owed me favours. My family owed me big time for what I'd done for them, the sacrifices I'd made. And this is how I thought. And anyway, the rows when we had around most evenings, I would just go grab a bottle and drive off somewhere. And sometimes I stayed away for the weekend. Sometimes I found myself somewhere in a blackout. I drove, went to Wales once, and years later when I got sober and we went down to Tenby, we passed Port Talbot, and I said, better not say what I said, not a very nice place, I wouldn't want to live here. And my husband said, well, we've never been there. I said, I have. And I'd been there, sat on the cliff, watched the sea with a bottle of vodka, tried to work out my life, where had it all gone wrong, what can I do about it? And the further down the bottle I got, the less I cared. By the time I was nearly 2 inches from the bottom, so what? And that was it, really. Anyway, my last year of drinking, I went down, started off in Weymouth, and went along the coast to Bournemouth. I had a friend that I hadn't seen for years and years and years. Always kept in touch, but hadn't been to visit. And I just turned up on a doorstep, and her sister owned a hotel. And I said, can you put me up for a couple of nights? And she looked at me and said, what's been going on? And I said, oh, you wouldn't believe what he's like at home, what I've had to put up with. And then my sob story. And I stayed there for, quite some time. And I worked in the hotel. I stayed there and worked in cleaning the bathrooms and bedrooms for my keep, so say. Not that I ate anything. I more or less stopped eating by that point. And I was in and out of blackout all day. I drank in the morning now before I even got out of bed. That lunchtime one was long gone. And I kept the bottle down the side of the bed, and I actually could drink laying down. I didn't even have to sit up. I could put the bottle in sideways and drink without actually sitting up. And then I go down and start doing, clearing the bar up downstairs, tipping everything from everybody's leftovers into one glass, whatever it was, and topping it up with Stella and drinking it. And that got me going for the day. When I cleaned the bathrooms, I went in everybody's wash bag. Well, not everybody's, 3 out of 4. And out myself to tablets. Everybody seemed to have bottles of pills and things. And they came down to breakfast in the morning looking pretty okay. So I thought, well, if I have a few of them, I might feel better. And I put them in my pocket. And when I went back to my bedroom where I had this room, I put all these pills in a great big green pub ashtray I had. And there was black and yellow ones and red ones and pink, all sorts. And I just, like that, with a few mouthfuls of vodka and hope to feel better. Can't say as I did. Anyway, this went on for a year. I can look back on that year now. Well, now I'm sober and I look at my family and I think, what did my kids think? Where did they think their mother was? What was I doing? The questions that must have gone on, you know, when's mum coming home? And I just assumed they were all right. And I was having a bit of freedom and I was going to go to America and live on a ranch, work with horses and stuff like that. It was fantasy, pure fantasy. And I did have a passport, but I didn't have a visa. And I went up to Petit France one day in London to get a visa. And you pull a thing out of the wall and you have to sit there and wait. And I sat there all day. I was dying for a drink. When they finally called my number and I went up to the counter and I said, I want a visa to go to America. She said, well, you have to fill these forms in, you have to do this. And I said, but I need it today. She said, oh, you won't get it today. It'll have to come in the post anyway. I said, that's no good to me, I'm going on the weekend. And I walked out and I've been there all day, put myself through agonies, waiting. But if I'd have got it, I wouldn't have gone. Never any money. I thought it was the answer. I couldn't live with myself. I hated what I'd become, but it wasn't my fault. You know, I was like this because I was made like this. He made me like this. And I was just unappreciated and I deserved some me time. Anyway, I went back to Bournemouth and life was just absolutely hellish. When the hotel was full, I had to move into a caravan out the back and sleep, and it only had half a roof. All the perspex was missing. And when I finished work in the bar about 1 or 2 o'clock, I went and fell into bed drunk because I used to out myself from the bar. And if I got up in the morning, it had been raining, I was wet, and I just used to think, oh, I'm all wet. And that's as much as it registered. Didn't bother me. I didn't think, oh, I better go and get out of these wet clothes because I might catch something. Didn't bother me. I went in, started doing breakfasts. Looked like a tramp. Stopped looking after myself. Goodness knows what the guests in that hotel must have thought of this. Reminds me of that Julie Walters old girl what served in Dinner Ladies. That's what I think I look like. Terrible mess. And I used to phone my husband. I crashed the car once, twice a week, several times. I crashed a car, drove away from an accident. Some woman was screaming, get the police, George, she's on drugs, because I got out of the car, couldn't hardly stand up. So I jumped back in the car and drove off, and I thought, I bet they got my number, but I'll have to hide my car. So I hid my car and I put it in a school playground, and then school was shut for some time and I couldn't get it out. Then in the meantime, after a few days I forgot where it was. I thought all the traffic wardens had my number and were just waiting for me. I was just paranoid. I felt my time was running out. I really did feel like this can't go on. And I didn't know what was going to happen, but it was just piling up. I was getting into more trouble than I was getting out of. Apart from when I phoned my husband up and said, oh, I've done the car again. Can you sort the insurance out? Or can you send me down some money? Or can you do this? And he did, for quite some time. And then one day I phoned up and said the same old sob story. And he said, you've chosen the life you want, and I don't want you to phone me up anymore. Well, I was initially angry, and then I was scared. Then a cold hit my stomach, because he was just about the last person I could pull in and rely on. I thought, oh, good old Alf, you know, he'll do it. And then I suddenly realised I had nobody there behind me, and then I was really, really fearful. And I don't know how much longer it was after that, something happened, and my friend, who by now she'd let me move into her flat, which she vacated, and yeah, she said, because she was staying at a hotel and I lived near the doctor's, I've got a prescription to be picked up, can you pop round and pick it up for me? So I said, yes, I'll do that, which I did. I went round and picked it up, and there was no thought in my mind other than doing that, and I picked the prescription up, took it back to the flat, sat on the bed, and I suddenly thought, that's the answer, isn't it? It's a godsend. I can take them tablets, I shan't wake up in the morning, all my problems will be over, and that was it. There was no thought of Samaritans, family, anybody that could help me. I'd reached the end of my tether, and this seemed to be the only solution. So I took all these tablets, and I don't know what they were. And anyway, obviously I'm still here, and I ended up in hospital. And when I wanted to come home, I phoned her up and said, can you come pick me up? And she said no, she was busy. Well, a nice friend. Nice friend, isn't it? Leave you like that. And when I got back to her flat, I could see why. Because the bed was up against the wall, and the coffee table was all stacked in bits, a cup against there. And I'd fallen around in the flat and broken everything and been sick and whatever else. I mean, I'd trashed the place, really. And, what could I say? I'd run up a phone bill of I don't know how much. I did pay it back eventually. And that's what I'd done. Worked in another hotel and came home at night at 2 o'clock in the morning, got my vodka out and sat on the floor with my ashtray, the phone and everything else. Popped myself up so that I wouldn't fall too far. And that's where I sat on the floor, because I knew if I was sitting in a chair, I'd fall out. And then I started phoning people up. And they'd say, do you know what time it is? And I'd say, don't matter what time it is, I phoned you up to have a chat. I talk to you. And they hung up on me and things like that. Well, I shan't phone her up again then. I expect they were quite grateful for that. But I had no recollection of a lot of that. And the friends that I have spoken to in recovery have told me certain things, which is quite horrific how I treated people and was unaware of it, and not least of all my family. And thank God I've had the time now in AA, now I'm sober, that I've had long enough to build bridges, make amends, and carry on with my living amends on a daily basis. And I never forget where I came from and what I'd done in those early days. Anyway, I came back to Swindon one day, decided I was going to leave Bournemouth, and I came back to Swindon. I met a friend in Marlborough who took me to my daughter's house because she said, you're too drunk to go back to Bournemouth. I met her in Marlborough, and for some reason I didn't take a drink that morning. Now, I drank as soon as I opened my eyes. And I wanted to see this friend, and don't ask me why, I wanted to be honest. And I knew when I had a drink, I wasn't honest, I full of it. And I don't know why I wanted to be honest, but that's why I didn't take a drink that morning. And I met her at 12 o'clock, and by now I'm really in a state. I'm picking my skin, pulling my hair, just twitchy and awful. And we go in a pub, and she bought me a vodka, which was in the bottom of a glass. You had to tip it sideways to see if there was anything in it, and that went down without touching the sides, and I had to get another couple of doubles in. And then I was like this, and she said, I think it's the drink with you, you know. I said, how can it be, Jackie? Look at me. You saw what I was like 10 minutes ago. You know what? I was shaking, one, I was in a terrible state. Look, see what I'm like now, I'm all right. She says, yeah, I know what you're saying, but I can't help thinking it's the drink that's doing it to you. And I couldn't see it. The drink was what got me through the day. And if I didn't have the drink, I just was falling to bits. So anyway, she took me back to my daughter's, and that's where I spent the next 10-15 days, sitting in an armchair. I didn't go to bed. The family had their little conferences up the end of the dining room, and every now and again somebody would turn around and look at me, and I sat there and I thought, yeah, go on, you just say something. I was furious at the position I was in. I felt helpless, and I was angry at the position I was in. And my husband came down to visit me every day, asked me how I was there anything I wanted, how could he help, and I told him to F off. It's all your fault. You're the cause of all this. I'm here because of you. And terrible. And he'd done that every day. And then one day, for some reason, I'd been sitting there all day drinking, quietly drinking. I didn't drink pints by now of vodka. I just sipped throughout the day. It was just enough to stop me going into anything. And I sat there and looked at myself from out there, and I just knew I was dying. I thought, you're going to die sitting in this armchair. And I'd wanted to die for years. Wish I was dead. Hope I don't wake up in the morning. And suddenly, when I knew I was dying, and I did know it, I didn't want to. I don't want to die. And that night he came down and he said, look at the state of you. And I said, yeah, I know. He said, you can't go on like this, you know. I said, no, I know. He said, can I get you some help? And I said, yes, please. And that, for me, was quite something, because I was full of venom and hatred and horrible, horribleness. And I said, yes, please. And I felt deflated. As the big book says, deflation of ego. And I felt that. It left me. I felt pathetic. He said, you'll have to have a bath. I'll take you to the doctors. I let him take me into the bathroom, run a bath and all that. And he took me to the doctors. And at this point, I think my higher power, which I recognise today, I didn't at the time, the coincidences we talk about, my own doctor wasn't there. I had to see a lady doctor that I hadn't seen before. And she was familiar with alcoholism, obviously, because of her advice. My own doctor isn't, but I've seen him since when I got sober, in my first year of recovery, when I was depressed, and I went to him, and he said, well, how long since you've had a drink? And you don't drink on weekends or anything like that. And I thought, you ain't got a clue, mate, what stopping drinking's all about. So I know if I'd have seen him on that day, maybe there would have been a different outcome, but I didn't. I saw this strange doctor, and she said, I can't help you, but I can give you the phone number of somebody that can. She gave us the number of a treatment centre. And in I duly went. Well, she didn't say it was a treatment centre. She said, I know someone that can help you. And help to me meant put it right. Do it for me. And I went in, and it was all very nice, nice gardens, and nice people greeted us and said hello to my husband. Yes, you can leave her here. She'll be well looked after. Thank you very much. And off he went. And then I was taken up to a room with four or five beds. Well, I'm sharing. I haven't got that room of my own. And I thought it was going to be like a nursing home, a well-paid nursing home, that you'd have your meals and you'd sit and do your cross-stitch and look out the window and stuff. And it wasn't like that, obviously. Anybody that knows anything about treatment centres, it was quite harsh. And but in a funny way, I felt safe. And I went into a group the following morning. I was detoxed for 5 days. And I went into a group the following morning, and they all introduced themselves as alcoholics. As it went round, I listened to that. It came to me and I said, my name's Gloria, I'm an alcoholic. And I only said that because I thought, if I don't say it, they might say, well, you better leave then. And I did feel safe. And it was my first bit of hope, if you like, that this place is going to be all right. So I said it, and I began my recovery in after a fashion. The 12 steps were on the wall. I was told we'd do the first five, so I only read the first five. I read them all, but they didn't really even make a lot of sense. And I read the first five. They didn't seem too bad. There seemed a lot of God. I didn't really like that, but I could leave that out. And won't take me long. So I began to share and write loads of writing. Powerlessness and damage I had to look at, and I didn't know what they were talking about. damage, what damage? What damage have you done to people? And unmanageability as well. And I didn't really even know at that point that alcohol was the problem. But on writing down or relating this wedding reception, that birthday, that christening, whatever, and I'd made a spectacle of myself. Had you been drinking that day? Well, yeah, wedding. And then something else. And had you been drinking? Yes. And every time you could put them, not dots together, I drank, I done this. Spectacle, humiliation, showed myself up. And I began to see a pattern. Oh, drink. And I never knew I was an alcoholic. I just never joined the dots together. So, when did I become an alcoholic? Whose fault is it? And who can I blame? Because it's not my fault, is it? And there's nobody in my family. I've heard many stories of families, entire families, and I haven't got anybody in my family I can point my finger at. So, I had to be the husband. It had to be the way I was treated. So that was it. There, my blame came in. That was well embedded in me, and the resentment. And also the fact that I didn't accept I was an alcoholic. I only admitted it. And there's a big difference in my book for me, because it wasn't until I did accept it, which was about 2.5 years later, that made the difference in my outlook to being an alcoholic and how I felt about doing all what I was doing. Resentfully, I was working the steps. When I came out of the treatment centre, I did go back home to this husband and my family. Deja vu in a house I hadn't been in for well over a year. Same furniture, curtains, everything was exactly the same, but I felt entirely different. I felt stone cold sober. I'd lost my sense of humour. Don't joke about anything. Nothing on the television entertained me. I was critical of how people behaved on the telly to each other. Couldn't see that they were acting. It was like for real. It was just an unreal, confusing time. And we both will now say today that when I got sober, we both expected life to revert back to what it used to be without the drink before it got bad. That's what we expected. No booze, no problem, was our little quote. And it wasn't like that. Didn't revert to what it was. And we were two different people. And now we began to grow apart. My husband did go to Al-Anon, thank goodness. And I told him to go and get honest. And I bought an Al-Anon book because he wouldn't read his. So I would read mine out loud. I said, oh, this is a good one. Today's reading's good. Listen to this. You will learn. Control, terrible. That need to change. I didn't like the idea that I had to change as well. You know, I was told in the treatment centre, you've got a lot of changing to do. I said, well, why? I've always been like this. And they said, yes, and look where it's got you. And that shuts you up when they give you that in the face. So... yeah, I had to change after doing a step 4 and 5 in there and looking at the enormous amount of things that were wrong, just about everything. There wasn't much on my positive side, all on the debit side. Was I going to have enough time to put all this stuff right? And anyway, I'm not the only one like this, you know. He's got some faults. We both need to do this. So I'm looking at his faults and how much he's not working the programme. And he's doing the same with me. And we went like this. And I went to lots of meetings. I had a good sponsor. I liked AA. I loved that hour and a half in an AA meeting. I wanted what those people had. I listened to what they said and I wanted to take that home. And when they talked about their partners or how they were at home, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do a nice kindness. I'm going to do something nice for a change. I'll go home and I'll put the kettle on and make him a cup of coffee. I'd rather go to bed without a cup of coffee than make him one. I'd sooner go without. Tonight I'm going to go home and make one. And the meeting's 9 or 10 miles away. 3 miles from home, I'm starting to waver. By the time I pull into my drive, it's on the line. And when I walk in the door and he's watching a war film, or the lights are on too bright and I like dim lights, it's all off. I'm not making coffee. And And that's what it was like. It was very hard for him, because we did expect me to be different when I was sober. But I realised today it takes time. You know, I was told it's not a race, Gloria. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. Change takes time, and time takes time. But I wanted to be sober in a year. I gave myself a year when I came out. I thought, 12 steps can't take that long, can it? And you don't get well until you've done those 12 steps. I thought, magic day one in the year two, you're well. Well, it was a big shock to wake up on my day one in year two to realise nothing had changed. I was still the same. Well, when am I going to be better? When am I going to be well? I had no idea of high power. I prayed in the morning to say, help me through the day, grant me this, grant me that, and everything else. And then I went and got on with my day. Never got another thought until the evening when I went to bed and said, thank you. And I used to say, thanks a lot, because it had been a lousy day. And I went to bed at night and went through my day. And there was so much that I'd done wrong, so much I wanted to change. One thing that did change for me was sarcasm was my forte. I could cut you quick with anything. I could make you look small. And I enjoyed it. And you would never get the better of me or the last word. Mm-hmm. And I stopped getting so much pleasure out of it. After I'd said it, I began to wish I hadn't. And that was a bit unkind. But now I couldn't say sorry. I was too proud for that. And it was things like that that I began to be uncomfortable with my old behaviour, the way I used to be when I was drinking and the first 6 months or a year. Now in year two, that behaviour isn't sitting so well. I just want it to be different. Anyway, after my husband walked out, he left me. He said I was worse now than when I was drinking, and he went and got a flat in Old Town for the summer, and he played golf all summer. When the evenings started joining, maybe I'm wrong taking his inventory, but he came home because he couldn't play golf after work, and he said he was coming home, and I thought, well, I'm moving out then, so I moved out. And this is what we were like. We just couldn't get it together. And anyway, after 2.5 years, we did go down to family counselling, and we sat in a group, and there was confrontation. It was very good. It was very eye-opening. For my husband, it was painful because he'd never done that sort of thing before, and I'd had that in the first treatment centre. And so I was not comfortable with it, but I was aware. And there's benefits from it. But for him, it was really quite uncomfortable. And they didn't give us much of a chance as a couple, these counsellors down there. And we came home, and after 2.5 years, my sponsor's sponsor, who used to be a counsellor, suggested I go down to Broadway Lodge and go in there for a couple of days and have a chat with one of the counsellors down there. And I said, yeah, okay. And I did. And I went in and met a lady called Dot, and she was about 4'9", fierce little thing. And it wasn't this Jeff who the sponsor had suggested. It was this woman, and she read me like a book. And I didn't like her. And she said, right, while you're here, Gloria, we'll be looking at steps 2 and 3. I said, I've done all that in the last treatment centre. She says, you haven't got a clue what it's about. And that's what we'll be looking at while you're here. If you're not happy with that, there's the door. Like you. And that's what we've done. And I think I was there a couple of weeks. And I was very fortunate to be allowed to stay, because really, I only went down for a couple of days. And I won't say I had an earth-shattering awakening or a realisation at that time, but towards the end of that 2 weeks, I did at least believe God worked through, there was a God of some sort, and he worked through people. I did believe people had it in them. I didn't. But I could believe that the help I'd had and everything that had come to me since I'd been sober had come through people that were just other alcoholics, and were somehow in a better position in life than I was. So she said, this group thinks you should go to Bath for 6 months and live there and grow up, take responsibility for your recovery. It's not your family's job to make you happy. That's yours. It's an inside job and it's down to you. And she did actually say, get off your arse and do it. It's not going to come to you. You have to work for it. And I didn't like that at all. I've got a nice four-bedroom home in Bar in Swindon and a family, and I've learnt a lot while I've been here, so I think I'll go home now and put it all into practice. She said, well, you think about it overnight and come to group tomorrow and tell us what you're going to do. So the next morning I went into group and she said, have you made your decision, Gloria? And I said, yes, I'll go to effing Bath. She said, good. And have you told Alf? I said, no. She said, half a decision then. And they give you nothing down there. But I went. But in my mind, before I went in and said I was going, I decided I'd go for a couple of months and then I'll go home, because then I can say to her, I tried it your way and it didn't work, I'm going home. And I ended up staying in Bath 20 months. 20 months. Nothing to do with me at all. And I believe that very first agreeing to go, reluctantly and angrily, with a big resentment, was the very first time I'd done something I didn't want to do. And I believe that was God's will. God's will wanted me to go to Bath, because these people had said so, and I didn't want to go. And for the first time ever, I'd done what I didn't want to do. And the benefits came to me thick and fast. I didn't have anywhere to stay. I had 35 quid. That soon went on B&B, and then I ended up in my Mini. And I had to go and get vagrancy allowance in the morning up the DHSS with all the other vagrants. And I sat there, I couldn't believe the position I was in. I was 2.5 years sober. I got a four bedroom place up in Wiltshire and I'm here claiming vagrancy allowance. But hey, it didn't matter. For some reason, it seemed all right. And this is what I've got to do, so I'll do it. And I did it. Then I got a room, which was wonderful. And I sat in the room that first night on the bed, and it's just as if somebody was in the room with me, physically touched me round the shoulders and said, it's going to be all right. And I felt that, and I felt God, if you like, higher power. Oh, it's lovely. And at the same time as that, the next day when I walked across the bridge into Bath, I looked at the ducks on the bank. I was looking up instead of the pavement cracks, and I realised I hadn't been walking around looking out. I'd been looking down. And suddenly life, everything was different. Nothing had changed at all, really, but everything had in my head, in the way I felt. And at that point, it was the accepting I was an alcoholic. And I realised then, I'm an alcoholic, so what? So what? I got a chance of getting well from this. I got a and then I started looking at all what I got. AA, the programme, a sponsor, tapes, cassettes, what you said this morning, meetings. I got all this at my fingertips. And I'm lucky. Instead of, I'm an alcoholic, I've got to go to meetings, I've got to do these steps, I've got to change. Everything changed because I accepted it. And that made such a difference. I got put through college for a year. I was very lucky to get it because they was already taking all their numbers, and Manpower Service Scheme said, we'll see if we can get you in, which they did. And I'd done that for a year to learn the horticulture. After that, I was offered a job, a year. My husband by now is coming down to visit me, by the way. We've not just spent all this time apart. And he came down and we met in a picnic area near Bath. He bought the dog. And we both spoke more to the dog than we did to each other, in all honesty, and the view. And then he started coming down and staying for a meal in the evening. We went to a pub and we'd sit and talk about the decor. And it's cost a fortune, this. And look at these, them curtains are nice. And I wouldn't mind, you know. And we talked about everything but us. It was very difficult, like in that first year or two, to talk about now, in the day, now stuff, because it was all so negative, and it invariably led to something in the past which would come up. Oh yeah, bring that up. Now we have another row. And you couldn't talk about the future because you had to keep it in the day. So it was all very, a lot of adjustment. But now we're in this situation in Bath, and he was coming down regularly, and we're beginning to open up and talk, and well, get honest about how we feel, how we see things, our hopes, and it all began to look more positive. And one day when I realised, when he drove off and I waved him and said cheerio, I missed him, and it was a bit like, oh, pity he couldn't have stayed a bit longer instead of, oh, that's it for another week. It all bit slowly changed. And I had a lovely sponsor that I was given on leaving that treatment centre, an American lady, very, very wise. I felt she took his side a lot of the time. I said, oh, take his side on it. She said, I'm looking at things as they are, Gloria. And somebody spoke this morning about making a mountain out of a molehill, dramatising, everything has to be exciting and big. All my problems were big, major problems. But after talking to this wise old sponsor, she'd bring them back down, I think. Why is she so clever? Why can't I know that? It was simple. It really was so simple. But then she said, you know, I'm on the outside. I don't have all my emotions muddling up the situation. You've got all your emotions going on in there that cloud everything up, and you can't see the truth for the facts, or the facts for the truth. Anyway, after this 20 months down there, I did come home, and I went back to the house that I left, that I said I couldn't ever go back to, because it was the house that made me drunk. I was never happy there. And if we hadn't moved there, I probably wouldn't have drunk. But anyway, I went back there and we began to talk about moving. And we bought a little cottage in what was the country. Now we've been a bit swallowed up, or about to be. And my lovely children, who I tried to make amends to twice, really, seriously, individually, one at a time, which is what individually is, isn't it? And they really didn't want to know. They were just happy that you're all right now, Mum. And my daughter did say, I knew it wasn't you, Mum, when I was trying to explain my behaviour and why it was like it was then for her. And she said, I knew it wasn't you, Mum. And they instinctively knew that the whatever was wrong with me, it wasn't their real mum. And they were difficult to make amends to, because I never really felt I could get it really across how sorry I was. But on a daily basis, I make it up to my kids, and I'm not a people pleaser. I don't say yes willy-nilly in spite of myself. But I don't interfere. I'm there for them, and they know I love them because I tell them all the time. And we have girly days out now. Obviously, they're all grown up. My eldest daughter's 57 now, and she's going through a difficult time. So we're there for her, as we are for the other two. And I've made my amends to many of the people that I had hurt. There are a few there now that they're vague people, they're employers and things like that, that they're no longer at these pubs and these hotels and places that I worked at. So I know I treated them shabbily, and that if I had the opportunity. The thing is, to become willing in my book, I mean, I think if I'm willing, and God knows I'm willing, he'll put those people in my way if I can't seek them out for myself. Because for years there was people that I certainly wasn't willing to. No way I'm going to humiliate myself by apologising to them. But when they begin to spend more time in my head than I want them there, I've got to deal with it, because there's nothing worse than thinking about somebody or being frightened to meet somebody because of you're ashamed of it. And a lot of those was my husband's family. I mean, every time we went to a wedding reception after I got sober, oh, I couldn't have eye contact because she was over there, and I hope she don't come over here and say hello. And that. But it's her brother, so obviously they get together, don't they? And he missed out on a lot of occasions because of me, because I didn't want to go. I couldn't face, didn't say that, but I couldn't face seeing them with my shame about it all. But I have made amends to them now. And now I don't feel better than, but I certainly don't feel less than like I used to. You know, I'm okay. I'm not as well as I hope I will be in the longer I go on and still work at this programme, because I find it ever challenging. Life's always changing. I've got 7 grandchildren, never seen me drunk, thank God. I hope they never do. My eldest grandson's 27 and he's got a Serenity Prayer tattooed on his chest because he thinks it's lovely. And he wants to know, when are you going to stop running these meetings, Grandma? Lovely. I'm so blessed in life today. I'm still married to the same husband. On March 11th, we were married 57 years, which is a miracle by any standards, but throw alcoholism in and it's a double miracle. It's just so lovely. He still goes to Al-Anon, and I and he will say that without the two fellowships, we would have struggled to make it. I'd have got sober, but whether we would have made it as a happy couple, I don't know. And I firmly believe that without me coming into AA and working the programme and him doing his bit, our marriage wouldn't have been like this. If we hadn't had alcoholism in our lives, I think our marriage would have been almost dull, if you like. We've got interest, we've got friends on both sides, wonderful friends. We have a big barbecue for both fellowships once a year, and we bring in the newcomers. I'm not saying this to brag, I'm saying this is, A, I'm able to do this because I'm sober and I've got a partner that knows my illness and is on his own programme, and we love doing it. And it's wonderful to feel so connected and joyful. If you've got a sponsee, who's got a sponsee, or a newcomer, you ask your sponsees, you've got a newcomer in tow, and she'll say, yeah, bring her along. And it might be the first time they've ever been to a social event without drink and had a good time and realise there is life after drink. You know, it don't all stop just because you have to put the drink down. I thought it was terrible. My daughter was 18 the first year of my recovery, and I tried everything to not give her a birthday party. I said, have the money and have a holiday. Have the money and do this. No, I want a party, Mum. I thought, oh. And I had to go along to this party. And it was an ordeal. It was terrible. And I had my orange juice, and people getting up dancing, and I thought, I'll never be able to dance again. Never have a good time. Never be able to go anywhere and enjoy myself. Poor me. Different now. I have a wonderful life. I laugh. Got a good sense of humour. Thank God. It comes back. Everything gets better. I've still got a sponsor. I go to step meetings once a week. Been doing that for about 29 years. And I got sober in 1984, by the way. I think you've all mentioned that at the beginning of your share. I'll mention it now. So, long may it last. I love it. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Gloria. It's Bernard. The bit we said there about, you know, when you're in a caravan with no roof and just, you know, when the unacceptable has become acceptable, isn't it?
Mm.
And the indifference to yourself, you know, and then the arrogance kicks in when you get sober, you know. It must be really, I can't imagine the hard work you put in, you and your husband, to, you know, to put, I think for anyone to put someone else's past behind them and to believe in someone, it's very rare, isn't it? You know, it's like, the only time I've ever seen it, right, like, I shouldn't say it, I guess, it's like, well, Mick's sitting out there when Sylvia was alive, like, I never really ever got on my feet. I was told I had to come and earn an honest shilling, so I never really got the money once I got sober because I was playing straight, you with me, you know? And one thing or another, it's like, I always felt a bit, because the kids didn't have an holiday, and Mick and Sylvie, they've always had, like, you look at people and you think, they got what I haven't got, you know, and you sort of follow it, don't you? You know, you want it in your life. And I'll never forget, to my dying day, I'll never forget the first holiday I gave to children, you know, and it's something that, I don't suppose they'd even remember it or whatever, but, you know, to know that, no matter what knocks get thrown at you, I've not gone back to the old way. I've not thought about, you know, getting easy money or, you know, justify certain behaviour, ripping people off or doing something, you with me? Because when you come in here and you get that fresh belief in yourself that I never had before AA, you know, I was always like the expectations to be what other people expected me to be, rather than I didn't have a clue what to be, you know. And when I came in here and I see people like Mick and other people around that are in the room today, you know, you're not lost no more, are you? You know, and you said something can all about the lies. I honestly, if I told you a lie, sincerely, I was telling you the truth. And it was people in AA said to me, stop being a game show host, Bernard. Just because you believe in it, it's not the truth, you know. And to take things, I think the courage that we have to show, the courage to be honest, and then the courage to accept the consequences of being honest. I couldn't have done that on my own. That was other people believed in me. Other people loved me long before I loved me. You know, people give me so much time. There was a book around at the time. There was a line and it says, if you knew what I was really like, you wouldn't let me know near your house, would you? You know. And the thing is, we all know what each other are like, don't we? Mm. It's just some of us are just a bit further away from it, and we don't want to go back to it, isn't it? And you can give someone a hand to get up and get out, you know. And how are you feeling now? You've done well, haven't you?
You start with
it. You give a round of applause. Come on. we'll have a cup of tea now, yeah? And we'll be back again, what, 10 minutes or so, yeah? And if you don't talk when you're pouring your tea, because the people behind you are cursing you. So pour your tea and keep walking. Thank you.